This is the Jason Burma Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
So first and foremost, let me say that that previous interview talking about Trump being let to win or installed one way or another to control demolition, the economy, it is the first time I've heard that from somebody in the financial system. And look, I think he makes a really good case, but I'm going to posit something a little bit different. I have to give a shout out to Pat Miletich, a good buddy of mine, UFC Hall of Famer. He keeps telling me and sometimes prank calls me through other phone numbers with people telling me that Trump's about to be installed to finish the job on America. And I don't have that take. I really do believe they are trying to put him in prison. But I think a lot of what he said, I mean, the historical references of, again, how we've become a nation of debtors, dependent on government, how we do not really own anything anymore, how we are taxed over the top on everything we do. And essentially, if they get their carbon tax in place, that's it. That's literally everything, just to let everybody know. That is a tax on a life force on the planet that we need to live. I just want to put that out there. So that's all real. So what do I think would have to happen for a similar situation to occur? Now, first of all, I hope we can avoid this situation of a total and complete crash in the economy. I'd often get phone calls at InfoWars when I was doing the Info Warrior with Jason Burmes, that, you know, Jason, I just stopped paying my taxes because I know that the economy's going to crash and the dollar's going to die. And we got the Amero coming. That was a big thing back then when we were talking about a North American Union, the combination of Canada, Mexico, and the United States. That never really had to happen because it happened highway system style by stealth. Okay, they didn't need an Amero. And I would always say this. First of all, don't do that. Even if the economy absolutely crashes and your dollars are not worth anything, I assure you that if you are indebted to the government or others, there will be a system in place that you absolutely will have to pay out some of it, or there will be a command control response to that. That is number one, numero uno. Number two, if we had some type of a terror attack or a wartime event that is completely and totally unprecedented, again, I did not think self-immolation was coming to the United States big time politically in 2024 on an array of issues. Here we are. If you had an escalation of war, in other words, Biden gets in, you've already got this large media narrative that we're on the brink of civil war, that white supremacists are everywhere, that Democrats hate Republicans and Republicans hate Democrats, and there's so many people that have been radicalized. Civil war is the biggest thing out there right now at the box office, and it's made by an extremely talented Hollywood guy. Everybody I've talked to that's seen it says it's an incredible film, especially the end of it. Whether you agree with anything that's being presented, you know, there's a lot of talk that it's apolitical. Don't believe that for a second. I might have to watch it and do my own little take. But my point being is if the United States was on a ground war in any respect or in some type of mass quarantine because of an event here, the total economy changes anyway. You don't need Trump for it to crash out and the Republicans to get caught off, you know, guard. No one believes Biden's running this show anyway. So, I mean, you could be in a really, really bad place if that happens. And I'm praying it's not. I'm not hoping for it because I want people to be in happy places. And you can do that by fancying a bank holiday weekend and a music festival for truth and freedom with your tribe. with 30 awake artists, including Danny Ramping and Mobius Loop, an all-night acoustic fire pit, bouncy castles. Everybody loves those bouncy castles. Doesn't matter where you go. And Hope Sussex for the children, plus loads of amazing stalls and scrumptious food vendors. This is an event not to be missed by anyone who's aware of the truth of the world. A Stand in the Park and In the Light paper present Stand in the Light, a truth music festival in the beautiful Lake District on May 24th to the 27th. You get 4 days of camping and full access to the whole festival for just £60 plus a booking fee. Children under five come free. There is no bargain, better bargain anywhere. Visit our website now to make sure you don't miss out what will be a brilliant weekend for the whole Freedom family. StandInTheLight.uk. StandInTheLight.uk. We'll see you there, and we'll see you guys on the flip of this break with Adam Clark bringing the ruckus.
There's a lot going on, so it's important to stay informed and up to date.
Get ready, cuz here we go.
At the top, 30 minutes past, and when it breaks.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The CEO of X, formerly Twitter, Elon Musk, has warned that any account involved in engagement farming on social media, on the social media platform, will face suspension. And reportedly, he is going to use his new pet project AI, Grok, to help sniff out the offending accounts. Here with the story, joining me once again, is TNT News producer Adam Clark, a.k.a. Ruckus. What do you got for us, X and Musk style?
Well, we all know how much of a free speech absolutist Elon Musk is, so much so that he's ready to pass along the next round of deleting of free speech on his platform. He's going to let the AI do it for him. This is crazy. To be honest, I had never even heard of engagement farming, but when I learned what it was, I inherently already knew what it was because I used to be a marketing manager. I used to dabble with social media when social media was still fairly new. I didn't use it nearly as much as I use it now, but I helped other companies and individuals get started with it and taught them some tips and tricks on how to increase their engagement and get bigger audience and get their message out. I mean, that's the whole point of using social media, in particularly at that time. And I'm talking like maybe 6 or 7 years ago max, okay? So now it appears, no, that's a bad thing. If you actually have a social media account and you use it and get a whole bunch of followers, that makes you a piece of crap, apparently. According to Elon Musk, this is something called engagement farming, and he is angry about it. It has become a prevalent strategy among social media users, particularly influencers, seeking to boost their online presence. How dare they? What are they thinking? You're supposed to go to Twitter and just be fed what you're supposed to be learning there, apparently. However, this practice has recently come under scrutiny with prominent figures such as Elon Musk taking a stand against it. I witnessed this post that he made this morning almost in real time. It was like when it showed up on my feed, it said it was like 5 minutes old. And I was like, what is this? And I started looking into it and I was like, man, I would love to report on this. And here we are in the post that I'm mentioning. Musk warned, threatened users against engagement farming, stating that any accounts found engaging in this practice would be suspended and tracked and traced to the source. Well, how's he going to do that? Well, we'll get into that. He wrote, quote, any accounts doing engagement farming will be suspended and traced to the source. End quote. I just said that. I'm sorry. Doge Designer is a pretty popular source who provides updates on Elon Musk and his ventures. They reported how X will be employing Grok, the AI, to identify, eliminate, and track down the sources of engagement farming spam. For those unfamiliar, Doge Designer explains engagement farming refers to the artificial boosting of social media engagement. This can involve various tactics, according to Doge Designer, such as posting misleading clickbait, encouraging users to engage in giveaways or contests, sharing irrelevant content. I'm sorry, has anyone used X lately? And using others' original content for engagement purposes. That's the one that a lot of people are upset about. So what is it exactly? I'm going to refer to this is called One India. The writer is Medhuri Adnal, who perfectly explains everything for us. Thank you, sir or ma'am. In simple terms, Engagement farming refers to the practice of seeking to increase engagement metrics such as likes, comments, shares, and followers on social media platforms. In this case, this is often done through artificial memes, such as participating in engagement groups where users agree to like and comment on each other's posts in a reciprocal manner, like I scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. One common method of engagement farming is through participation in Twitter spaces, where users join multiple spaces simultaneously without adding any real value to the conversation. This can create the illusion of a highly engaged audience and can help users grow their personal brand. However, the tactic has several drawbacks. Firstly, the audience for these engagements is often limited to the members of the engagement group, making it unlikely to add any real value to the content, i.e. like a serious, crazy echo chamber. Secondly, social media algorithms are becoming increasingly adept at identifying and penalizing posts that are part of engagement farming schemes. Finally, while engagement farming can help a post gain visibility, it does not change the intrinsic value of the content itself. If the content is not compelling, it is unlikely to resonate with a broader audience beyond the engagement group. Musk's efforts could greatly improve the credibility and user engagement of the X platform, yet effectively addressing the issue of artificial engagement while preserving freedom of expression will require continuous efforts to find the right equilibrium. I'm not so sure if the answer is using artificial intelligence to hunt down artificial engagement, Jason, but what say you?
So, first of all, I haven't seen any lower threshold of female sex bots on Twitter that randomly just start liking my post, which downgrades it, by the way. I'm already got a pretty good shadow ban. I know we can't talk about those things, but then I do see that I do get engagement from the bots, okay, that are very obvious bots. Let's start there. Secondly, this is very broad. This does go against what is just engagement farming, which is a real thing, and I'm going to get to in a moment. So in reality, when they were telling you that Russian bots had infiltrated the 2016 elections, remember they'd hacked the elections, that was never real. What actually happened was you had individuals that had many sock accounts and then private message boards that made up a group called MAGA3X. Now, in this group, you did have extremely influential, high count right wingers. Cernovich is said to be in this group. Roger Stone is said to be in this group. Matt Couch at the time was said to be in this group. Justin Mackey, the meme case guy, you know, Ricky Vaughn, also in the group. And so was the guy who I often refer to as Microchip, because I have to refer to him as Microchip because he flipped to the FBI and we've never found out his real identity. Now, these people were extremely successful in doing the type of thing they're talking about. They would go through and share memes on the board and say, hey, we're going to try to boost this post. And then that person would then go to their other crowds and try to boost that post. And then they would use not only sock accounts they had created, but they would use what? Farms where you could hire people for the type of likes and retweets that on a short level will boost it enough that then it gets to real people. And then what? That engagement actually doesn't artificially, but naturally goes up. All right. If we were dealing with something like that, okay. But we're not. Okay. And the only reason it's being brought up right now and massaged this way is because we are in an election cycle. And I'm sorry, as much as I loved having Joe Lombardi on, I do not believe that they're trying to let Trump back in there. I think they're working. I mean, look at our first guest, Todd McGreevy. They're not just trying to rig the machines that vote for you, folks. They're trying to rig the polling machines that can't be that far away from the machines themselves. That's just opinion. I guess I'm a conspiracy theorist. What say you in this last minute, Adam?
What a convenient way to start making important voices on Twitter disappear, because a lot of folks will get caught up in this unfairly. That is my official stance on this thing here, Jason.
I absolutely agree. I think that's the other aspect of this, right? You conveniently get to censor people behind the scenes, maybe up front, get rid of them, suspend them for a time period. There's never any repercussions for this. Doesn't even matter if you paid for that blue check mark. You've signed away everything with your consent to use. I mean, again, this is another illustration of me or for me that Twitter continues to be an extension of this same media military industrial complex we constantly talk about. And there is more than even the Faustian bargain that our guest last night, Amy Peacock, discussed. This is techno-fascism at a level most cannot comprehend. We got to stop playing team baseball, and we got to stop bending the knee and worshiping these cult-like figures that are really just mouthpieces and different flavors for the same agenda. Adam Clark, you have a hell of a weekend, my friend. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about more sunshine and rainbows. No, we're not. We're going to talk about the possibility of World War III via the escalation in Israel with Iran. You're not going to want to miss it. Stuart J. Hooper up after this. It's TNT Radio Live.
TNT's Patrick Henningsen.
All the focus of the West, of Washington and its allies, are all focused on Israel right now to support and help Israel and to somehow contain and deter Iran. Okay. So that means that Russia kind of has an open field with regards to what it wants to do. So think about that for a moment. Could we have a situation in this new world, this multipolar world, where the Iranians and the Russians, they're allies, and certainly Russia's not going to slap Iran on the wrist for this latest salvo against Israel? Why? Because it absolutely ties up the United States and its allies right now in the Middle East.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT.
It sounds pretty good.
It sounds real, dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
As things have actually continued to escalate between Israel and Iran, the officials out and about in the media sphere are trying to downplay the situation that occurred last night. To talk about that and much more is Stuart J. Hooper. He is academic and one of my favorite political analysts in the game. Stuart, what say you on these latest strikes? Because again, we saw the Iron Dome affair. We saw the drones. But last night, we did have a military strike. A lot of people were worried right there that might have been the flashpoint. Now it seems cooler heads have prevailed, and at least the talking points have loosened up.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for having me back, Jason. Love being on with you as well. Like I said, been following you for many years now, and you're one of the only voices out there that can bring a clear head to this stuff, because like me, you don't jump into this left versus right thing, winners versus losers. And this really is the perfect example of that. If the world heads down the road of escalation, if it heads down the road of a regional conflict, if not a World War III, which I've been warning about now for a very long time, nobody wins. There's no winner in that whatsoever. I don't care what your religion is. I don't care what race you are. I don't care what political party you are. Everybody loses. That's the bottom line. So really, if we want to focus our efforts towards something as a species collectively, it should be avoiding World War III, regional conflict, ending militarism as much as we possibly can. Now, as for last night, yeah, there are differing ways to interpret this, but as you said, I think it's fair to say cooler heads have prevailed, thankfully. Now, this was not guaranteed to happen, and there certainly would have been voices in Netanyahu's ear, very close to his ear nonetheless, that would have been saying, yeah, we need to go ahead and strike Iran. This is it. The time is now. Let's go after the nuclear sites, all of their military sites, everything. Go and hit it and hit it hard. This is our chance to do it. This is what we've been wanting to do for the last 20 years. We can finally go and get the job done. Well, thankfully, that didn't happen. And I think it's for various reasons. But I think the big one is that Israel has already dramatically overplayed its hand when it comes to Gaza. So because it's gone so far with Gaza, and we're now at 33,000 plus dead at the last I checked, this has completely crushed Israel's international image. And if Israel now opens a new war with Iran, there aren't going to be a whole lot of people out there in the world that are just going to be willing to say, yeah, you know what, we support Israel. Israel's in the right here. They're going to be thrown under the political bus yet again. So this was really not the time to go to war with Iran. If that was their overall plan, there probably was a better way to get there than waiting 6 months, killing 33,000 people in the process. But thankfully, we're not there. So that's something to celebrate.
So now what can we expect? Because obviously I don't see a de-escalation in the Gaza Strip. Like we've talked about, it's openly now being said there is no two-state solution, even if it had been alluded to before. Like you said, you don't think that they have the manpower or the public support to have a full-on conflict with Iran at the moment. At the same time, they've leaned into AI and this Lavender system. There's been some denials, but now it's so widely reported, it is very, very hard to not think that, yes, they are employing this. Do you think they're also employing AI in the targets that they're attacking and how far they're willing to escalate? Because obviously they've picked those targets, right? Are they utilizing this system to see how far they can poke the bear without scaling into a full-on global conflict? Or are they just kind of waiting for the right moment to spark that global conflict?
Yeah, great question. So when it comes to this Lavender AI system, you sent me a few articles on this earlier to look over. There's some interesting lines in there from the Israelis themselves where they say that, well, we're using this, but it's just a tool that our analysts use. And it's just like any other tool that we give our analysts. Well, the problem is we don't know the extent to which those human analysts are actually relying upon Lavender over all of their other tools. So if they are prioritizing this over everything else, this is not good. And we've seen multiple instances of where computer systems have failed in the past. There are very famous examples of nuclear early warning systems that have failed in the past. And commanders, thankfully, on the ground said, yeah, that's got to be wrong. That's got to be a mistake. This can't be real. We're not going to hit the big red button. Famous incident where this happened to a Soviet early warning system. It was triggered. The alarms are going haywire. The Soviet commanders are in this little command post, and all of a sudden they're thinking that the US has launched a first strike. Turns out that no, it was actually just the sun coming up over the horizon and causing chaos with the system's sensors. So when you rely on systems like this to tell you what is or is not a target or what is or is not happening, the consequences can be very real. And it's possible, I think we discussed this before, that now they've been very real for over 33,000 people. To what extent was this system used for all of these targets in Gaza? And when it comes to Iran, as you were pointing to in your question as well, Jason, maybe they did use this to try to figure out what is or is not going to be a target in Iran, what's going to be something good to go after. But I think really for this strike on Iran last night, not even really... I don't think strike is even really the appropriate word for it, honestly. But they sent these drones, again, very not super capable systems at all, towards this city, which is right next door to Natanz, which is where the Iranian nuclear program is based. So much like Iran was saying to the Israelis, we have the capabilities to reach you if we want to. Israel was kind of saying back to the Iranians, well, we know where your nuclear facilities are and we can reach those as well. So what we have going on here in the video that I posted a couple days ago now, just talking about the Iranian retaliation, we're now a step past that, is that these two nations are currently in a game of geopolitical chess. Now, the problem is This may not go the way that either side expects it to play out.
My biggest question right now, when we're talking about whether or not this AI Lavender system is being fully employed, is what exactly is a member of Hezbollah or Hamas or a terrorist? Because when we look at the United States and the war on terror, if you looked at what the definition of an enemy combatant was, it was a military able man, age 16. That's it. I mean, that was the broad. I mean, so they're not a man, they're a 16-year-old kid. Can they hold a gun? Probably. That's a target. That's pretty broad. And I would also say that obviously they're utilizing this for political dissidents, those that have spoken out. We have seen people for a very long time who have reported on the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, also not just targeted by AI, but targeted by the Israeli military, IDF, et cetera, themselves. And that should be a stain on them and really, really an example to the rest of the world of what they're capable without AI, drawing these very, very cold-blooded conclusions. So now with it, I think it personifies that even more, and that is an extremely dangerous thing. We got to take a break. When we get back, we're going to shift gears. We're going to go to another part in the world. We're going to be talking Ukraine and Russia and William Burns of the CIA saying the obvious, but why is he saying it? It's my show. I'm Jason Burmis. More TNT Radio Live after this.
And here's the news.
Extra, extra. TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has expressed concern that EU and NATO leaders are close to deploying forces to Ukraine, describing the mood in Brussels as one of war readiness. A Russian Tupolev Tu-22M3 supersonic long-range bomber crashed in the Stavropol region of southern Russia. Former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has suggested that Western countries might want to liquidate Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, responding to news of a Polish man's arrest for allegedly plotting Zelensky's assassination.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Always nice to hear Dmitry back on the scene when we're talking about liquidation, aka assassination of global leaders. Let me just start with that one. And always really great to see supersonic Russian nuclear jets falling out of the sky. When I saw that, I'm not even weighing in on it because apparently it didn't have any kind of payload on it. It's not quite clear how it came down. Apparently the Ukrainians were able to shoot it down. But we have this story out of the United States, William Burns of the CIA. A lot of people not even familiar with the guy, CIA director. Not the greatest. Epstein associate, definitely in that black book having meetings with him. But he's come out and candidly said, look, Ukraine, they're running out of ammunition. They might lose this war on the ground this year. And the bottom line is they can never win the war on the ground ever. They can't win the war on the ground in 2024. They can't win the war on the ground in 2025, 26, 27. Not unless there's literally some kind of first world nation war that escalates more than the ground warfare we have. So there is no chance for them to win, but this is definitely a plea to give them more money, more funding, and continue to fund what is becoming a forever war, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. The only entity that is winning in any conceivable way with the war in Ukraine is the military-industrial complex, much like it's also winning with Israel-Iran. There were estimates that came out, I forget who published it, that the air defense of Israel over the weekend, that cost somewhere in the region of $1 billion. So that money is going somewhere, and it's going into the military-industrial complex. And much like the same with Ukraine, and they just today have now apparently gotten the votes that they need for the US Congress to now go right ahead with signing essentially another blank check for both Ukraine and Israel. And I think to an extent, though, that the dam is starting to break on a lot of this. I'm not sure if you've seen Tucker's interview with Joe Rogan yet or not. I'm about a third of the way through it, maybe halfway through it. But he's now coming out, Tucker that is, he's now coming out and basically saying what I've been thinking and trying to think through for the past couple of years, in that this is not really a democracy in any sense of the world, in any sense of the word. There's no way that you can really call the United States a democracy anymore, because it doesn't matter what the people think, doesn't matter how many people think it. The power structure, the people in charge, are always going to do what they want to do anyway. It's only on certain issues that in the grand scheme of thing ultimately don't really mean much at all. Wedge issues, abortion, guns, the border even, there are some legitimate differences. But on the economy or on foreign policy, both the Republicans and the Democrats, they're telling us the exact same thing. So they're sending us down the exact same path, which is towards destruction. And it's towards the permanence implementation of this group of elites over American society, over American politics, really to the expense of everyone and everything else. So until we decide that we're done trying to play this Democrat versus Republican game, we're not really going to get anywhere.
So do you think, you know, I had a guest on tonight, he thinks they're letting Trump back in, they're going to use him for the controlled demolition of the economy. But I truly think that if Trump were able to win the election, and there is not a false flag type event or an escalation of a first world conflict before then, he wants to de-escalate these conflicts. Perhaps you wait for that moment until after he's sworn in. But do you essentially think there would be no difference between a Trump presidency or a Biden administration when it comes to these global conflicts, especially with Russia and Ukraine? I mean, again, a lot of people hated him for it, but Trump had a pretty good relationship with Putin. They talked. One of my favorite parts of the Trump presidency that I give him, you know, kudos for, was stepping across that border for the first time in North Korea and taking away the idea of a boogeyman. You know, I don't like boogeymen. I want people to talk. I want diplomacy. I don't want to talk about global assassination and thermonuclear capable planes falling out of the sky. That's bad news, Brown. So what do you think? Is it all a facade? Is it all a show? Or if Trump gets in there again unscathed, does this de-escalate?
Great question. So I think Trump, for the most part, I think it's fair to say that he would probably kind of go along with the, let's say, agenda broadly. But he raises enough issues for the people that are really in charge that they would much rather that he's not there. In other words, he will say a lot of things that can get himself and the United States into some political trouble. But is he really going to do much to change it? I mean, like you said, when he was first in office, there were some positives, like going to North Korea, like meeting with the leader over there, like crossing the border. That was good. But he also did other things like tear up the Iran deal, which is part of the reason why we're currently in the situation that we're now in. He assassinated Soleimani. I think what you'd get with Trump, and again, that's not to say Soleimani is a great guy that we should all love, right? It's to say that maybe you shouldn't just go around just assassinating generals of foreign countries you don't like, because that might lead to some unparalleled consequences that maybe you're not ready for. But I think with Trump, I think he potentially offers somewhat of a political solution to the war in Ukraine. I think he will really take that on as his thing that he could get accomplished. I can solve the war in Ukraine. I can bring the two sides together and we can resolve this politically. Maybe, hopefully, let's say. But I think with Israel-Palestine, Trump is perhaps even more of a threat than Biden, because we saw what Trump did with Israel during his presidency. He declared that Jerusalem is just Israeli. This is the capital of Israel. You got Jared Kushner in there, who's of course very close to the Israeli government. So he's going to be in that sort of hardcore Israeli supporting Republican core, which I think he doesn't have as much of a problem with as the other elements of the foreign policy establishment. So with Israel, I think it could get worse. Maybe with Iran, it could get worse. But with Russia, Ukraine, there may be room for a solution.
Well, I guess there's a lot of gray area there. We're going to be keeping an eye on it. Stuart, a pleasure as always. Really appreciate you. Everybody needs to check out your stuff over on X, Stuart J. Hooper. That's where you can find them. We got to take one last break. The time flies by here, 2 hours like that. We're going to be talking about the school systems, globalization, and more with John Klejcik. You're not going to want to miss it. More Jason Burmis after this. It's TNT Radio Live.
I said, could she die? And the doctor said she could. It was so scary.
When I started clawing at my neck and trying to breathe, and I thought, you know, what are we going to do if I die here? How's everyone going to go on?
When someone's gravely sick or injured in the bush, they rely on the Royal Flying Doctor Service. But now the Flying Doctor needs your help to fund vital medical equipment and supplies. Please search Flying Doctor online to give a regular gift of just $10. You can help equip the Flying Doctor's teams to respond to any emergency anywhere. Search Flying Doctor online. Become a part of the Royal Flying Doctor Service and help save lives in the bush.
One scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
When the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
I'm relying on luck, but who knows if it'll be on my side.
When it comes to disasters and emergencies, it's not a matter of if, but when. Take control. 1. Assess your needs. 2. Make a plan. 3. Engage your support network. Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell.
Disassembling the lies and reassembling the truth. This is the Jason Burmis Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
My final guest of the evening is the author of School World Order. He's also a journalist over at UnlimitedHangout.com. John Klejcik is with us. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. So look, I've been down in the dumps with a lot of these stories. There hasn't been any good news out there, but we're going to start with some good news. We got this Murrieta board that has defied California State and said, you know what? We are going to let parents know if kids are trying to transition into another sex or get on hormone blockers or essentially, you know, be pushed into this transgender movement. And I think that this is obviously a positive thing because we've seen so much of a movement against the nuclear family and against parental rights in these state school systems. You've documented this and how it's incrementalized over the decades. What are your thoughts on this one? This is a pretty good win for us, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, when I first wrote my book, you know, this was before lockdowns and everything. So I was hoping that, you know, we had more of a chance to kind of reform the public school system. Ever since then, I've really been promoting homeschooling while kind of, you know, still keeping one foot in the other camp, trying to tell people, even if you take your kids out, you should still be active in the local school boards. And this is a good example of why we shouldn't give up on the local school boards and the importance of them. And it also illustrates, you know, one of the dangers of, you know, the charter school movement, which is that a lot of them don't have elected school boards. So this is a good example of when they actually are voting and upholding the values of the parents in their communities.
Now, a lot of people don't understand kind of the globalist influence in our school system, not only through NGOs and things like the Rockefeller Foundation and other supposed philanthropic and benevolent associations, but directly through the United Nations itself. The United Nations has courses out there that anybody can take part in. They actually have a school system in their building in New York City, and that education obviously expands throughout the country via programs like the Model UN and more. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so they actually have courses for like professional development for lifelong learning that basically educators or business leaders or people that run nonprofits, you can take courses in basically like sustainable development principles or equity principles, so you can sort of launch some of those pilots at your institution. But then they also have, one good example of some of the coursework that they have for students came right around lockdowns with something called the UNESCO Global Education Coalition, which was a partnership between UNESCO and a bunch of big tech corporations. I wrote about it in my series Teachnocracy at Unlimited Hangout. But that one actually partnered with several ed tech companies. And there's actually an online digital platform known as FutureLearn that sort of came out of something called the Open University, which goes back to something called UNESCO Study 11, or it was a key partner in something called UNESCO Study 11. So those are just a handful of different course packages that they have at the adult lifelong learning level and also at the school age K through 12 level.
So who are the people that are getting involved in these e-learning courses, as you said, you know, that are going beyond, you know, just education via, you know, you're a kid, you're into the Model UN, you're into government. Who are the ones that are now expanding on this SDG agenda?
Well, one of the lesser known institutions that I covered in my Teachnocracy series is actually a global union federation known as Education International. And several leaders at Education International also have leadership positions in unions in various other nation states. So Australia, the Netherlands, and the United States stand out in particular. And some of these people, like Fred Van Leeuwen, and the woman's from Australia, her name escapes me. But these people also have ties to the World Economic Forum. And so it should be noted that Education International is also involved in pushing the UNESCO Global Education Coalition to help facilitate, quote unquote, distance learning during the whole lockdown phase. So that's one institution that is not on a lot of people's radars.
So when you're talking about UNESCO and you're talking about remote learning, for instance, you know, what are we discussing with that? Because it seems like this is globalized, streamlined education, and a lot of it has to do, at least their front, and, you know, they're now teaching fifth graders this in America about global equity through these education systems. Now, look, I'm all for equality of opportunity and giving these kids a good education. But when we're talking about an equitable outcome, that's a very different thing, is it not, John?
Yeah, so the whole equity metric is basically an extension of the broader sustainable development goal platform. So the equity portion of it sort of focuses on basically alleviating poverty. But tied in with it is also a wellness metric. And then the environmental part would be the SDG that focuses specifically, what was formerly the MDG, sustainable development, now became sort of this umbrella overarching term. But all of them sort of work together for social credit indexes. So what we might know is one of the most popular would be the ESG. So the environmental, social, and governance scoring, the S. The social part would encompass the equity and the wellness, the E, environment, and would encompass the sustainability metrics. But all of that together can be used for basically social credit scoring. This is where the ed tech comes in, because the ed tech is going to data mine the students through the online platforms, and it's going to use that data not just to facilitate their career pathways, in other words, tell them what jobs they're going to have in the future, but it's also going to determine their access to the broader public square and commercial services based on these social credit indexes that they data mine from the ed tech.
So let's talk about that, because I think that's really important. We're all worried about a centralized social credit score, but what we don't realize, despite the fact that we don't have that in this country yet, we do have a bunch of these different smaller social credit scores, like it or not. Now, you're talking about global metrics, but it was reported on years ago, companies like Google and Apple already had a social credit score based in your behavior. This is really putting it into a level that will be sorted really through automated AI processes. Am I wrong?
No, not at all. And, you know, they're sort of pivoting now because, you know, as you see, there's a lot of sort of pushback against the ESG agenda. And they actually are, there's other indexes that are sort of, they're coming out with. Some of these include like Global Flourishing Index, Opportunity Indexes, Well-Being Indexes, Good Country Indexes. These were sent to me by my friend Lisa Logan, who writes at The Federalist. But all of these together, as you know, right, are going to be basically in ed tech, the artificial intelligence is something specialized that we call adaptive learning courseware, right? It's an adaptive learning algorithm. But adaptive learning algorithms have a very close relationship to some of the large language model generative AI programs that we're seeing. So the adaptive learning courseware that basically uses operant conditioning algorithms to psychologically train the students to achieve various competencies, those can be integrated or interfaced with basically a large language GPT model. In other words, like an artificial tutor or an artificial teacher that could basically facilitate those adaptive learning modules in ways that sort of expand beyond the screen-based stuff that we've been used to over the last couple of years.
So let's talk about that, because I think that's really, really important. A lot of people don't realize that we're not just talking about a telesystem where you have an instructor, but in fact, that instructor probably is not going to be human. And it's not just in our education systems, it's also in our healthcare systems, where they are now developing avatar-specific educators based on these models. And unfortunately, we've already seen, with AI in particular, garbage in, garbage out. Perhaps there was no more visual confirmation of this than with Google. That is obviously a leviathan in the tech space, should have the best AI available. And then they launch their AI product and you're getting black German soldiers during World War II. You're getting just the most absurd things ever. That shows the danger of narrative-driven AI. And I, for one, want to keep that as far away as possible from our education systems, especially our young children. But really, that's the place that they would like to institute it first, correct?
Yeah, you know, when I wrote my book, I thought that, so I basically covered what I saw as a progression of ed tech, starting from screen-based devices, moving to wearables, and then eventually implantables like a Neuralink or other types of, perhaps down the future, nanotech that would then interface with the generative AI. And I thought that I would see more development, common usage of the wearables before I saw the popularity of the GPT emerging. And that's not something that I anticipated, but now that we're here, yeah, I tutor at one of the schools where I teach. I'm an adjunct at a couple of different community colleges and one university. And when I tutor online, a lot of times there's nobody there, like nobody shows up for appointments. And so I'm thinking like, it's probably not going to be too much longer till somebody pitches getting a generative AI to replace us, because if you buy this one bot, right, that can service every student, and you only have to pay for it once, you don't have to pay me for all the hours that I don't have a student. So, you know, I can see that coming around the pipe. And what's funny enough is it's one of the impetuses that kind of got me started writing about this was I had been tutoring with a different company, an online company in the past, and they had IBM's Watson piloting with us. So IBM's Watson is, you know, one of the sort of precursors to some of this GPT AI. And it was specializing in some adaptive learning stuff. So it's it's been several years since I saw that they were basically data mining what we were doing as instructors in order to basically refine the AI for those purposes. And now it looks like we're at the space where generative AI could give basic, you know, answers to a lot of the questions that students typically have in a tutoring session. And what would be beneficial for the establishment would be that GPT is going to give the official politically correct answer, right? And is not gonna push the student to think beyond that.
And that's my biggest issue, right? I think that the fact that they're not going to be based in critical learning or civics and those type of discussions, but I'll take it even a step further. Even if this thing, AI, were delivering just the basics, 2 + 2 = 4, and they were getting it right down the line, mathematics, physics, biology, etc. I mean, biology obviously is going to be a problem with the narratives that are out there, but let's say it got everything right. There's still something to be said about the human interaction between you and an educator, and then the social interaction with you and other students that I think is lacking and missing. Sure, it could be utilized as a tool some of the time, but we both know that they're going to drive this into the primary way of education. And that, to me, is extremely dangerous and troublesome. And it gives me hope that there has been a resurgence in homeschooling, in holding people accountable. So, you know, for those out there that are concerned with the way the school system is and want to get their kids out of some of these indoctrination centers, what do you suggest are some of the first steps that they can take? Or if they're stuck in there, what are some of the tools that parents can use to stay close enough to their children that it doesn't go off the rails, John?
Well, I mean, if you can, and I know that it's not necessarily an option for everybody, if you can, I highly recommend homeschooling your kids, you know, maybe finding some like-minded parents in the neighborhood to create some co-ops or some pods. You can pool your resources together, and people who can specialize in particular areas or particular curriculums can kind of supplement each other's instruction. You know, you could reach out to people like me to maybe help supplement some of the instruction as well. If you have your children are in the public school still, and they necessarily are subjected to a lot of the curriculums that you might want to take them out of, or some of the data mining, I would just say try to be as conscious and aware as possible of the assignments that they take home, whether written or digital or otherwise. If you ever see anything in there where they're questioning the children about anything regarding mental health, psychological status, religious affiliation, political opinions, technically these things actually are not allowed. These are under the Protection of Pupil Rights Amendment. You can actually have those curriculums audited, and you could, if found to be violating the PPRA, you could request that those things are expunged, or that your child not be have to participate in it. So those are some of the things you can do to manage the situation if you're in the school. But I highly recommend if you can to take your kids out.
Now, we are in an election year. But as you know, this agenda seems to be pushing forward no matter what. It didn't really lose much steam during the Trump administration. Do you think in this arena of education, globalization, the tools of AI, automation, etc., do you think it makes a difference whether Trump or Biden or whoever gets in this next presidential cycle? Or do you think these things are pushing forward no matter what, and we're certainly just going to have to navigate them?
Oh, no, I mean, I think they're going to be pushing forward regardless. You know, if Biden stays in, we might see a continuation of emphasis on wraparound services and community schools from like the left wing flavor. If Trump gets in, he's going to ride this push for school choice and the public private charter school and voucher partnerships that can fund the online charter schools to basically go into your home and data mine your students through your homeschool voucher. So in either instance, we're going to have to deal with sort of the encroaching stakeholder capitalist version of education, which is why I, like I said, I just recommend that if you can get your kids out, get them out, homeschool pods. And then in the meantime, right, you can keep going. You still pay taxes. You can still go to those school boards and you can still voice your opinion. Just be, you know, very careful and very polite, because nowadays they like to label people domestic terrorists for having too strong of an opinion.
Yes, they do. Let people know where they can get the book, brother.
TryingDay.com, TryingDayBooks, or SchoolWorldOrder.info.
All right, John, thank you so much for joining us. And guys, thank you for joining me on the show this power-packed week. Again, I didn't know that we were going to end it with self-immolation. Let's hope that this trend ends. Let's hope we get a little more peace in the world, in the Middle East, over in Russia, in Ukraine. We can start right here in each other's hearts. Remember, folks, this guy, it's not about left or right. It is absolutely always about right and wrong. I love you guys. We'll see you next week here at TNT Radio Live on the Flip Side.